listening to the Badass Lady Folk of Brooklyn here on Radio Free Brooklyn. I'm your host, Mari Pack.
And I'm Christine Stoddard.
You were just listening to Toxic Moxie's Talking Hands, our new theme song. This week, we are very excited to interview an artist and our dear friend, Jessica Reedy. Welcome, Jess.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, we're so happy to have you on. Jessica Reedy is an English and writing professor and a writer of poetry, fiction, and nonfiction. She's the winner of the Penelope Nivens Award, and her work has appeared in Narrative Magazine as Story of the Week, the Los Angeles Review, the Missouri Review Blog, and other publications. She worked on her BA at Hollins University and her MFA at Florida State University. She is a yoga instructor and often leads yoga and writing workshops, independently and in collaboration. She also works her Romani Gypsy, this is in quotations, family trades, card reading, palmistry, healing, and dancing. So first, can you tell us a little bit about the workshops you have going on right now?
Yeah, so I teach a workshop at Sacred Sounds in Greenwich Village, Sacred Sounds Yoga, with Alyssa Lewis. And it's a yoga and writing workshop that is geared toward creating new material. And usually we start off with some yoga, maybe a little meditation. I might read an inspiring piece. And we try to incorporate the themes of the writing class, especially the kind of prompts we use. We do themes often. Our last one was the solstice, and the one before that was fate and chaos. Into the yoga movements as well. So if we're doing something introspective or focusing on character building, we might work on, you know, inversions or reflective poses. And it's really fun. And then we intersperse them with journaling and round off with a writing prompt, some craft talk, and an opportunity to share and get new feedback on brand new work. And so it's very, very supportive and more geared toward, like, what did you hear in the piece? What did you like? What are you curious about? To encourage writers to maybe take it to another draft and expand it. Yeah, it's a good time. And then I have one at the Tarot Society in Bushwick. And that one is more focused, it's called the Writer's Circle. It's more focused on creating writing rituals. And so we open with different kinds of rituals, invocating, you know, creativity. We'll do a little bit of ancestor magic. And the whole purpose is to focus on creating space, creating a sacred space to write, and making writing an empowering and nourishing, hopefully daily ritual. And then we go into craft talk, writing prompts, and then an opportunity to share just like the yoga and writing circle. So the whole purpose is really, I want people to come in, you know, feel inspired, create new work, and leave with something fresh rather than, you know, feeling a little let adrift, and, you know, just having writing looming over them. I want it to be positive and productive.
Yeah. So how do you come up with these different exercises?
A lot of it is inspired by everything I read, and what comes up with my students as I'm teaching them at the university. And sometimes, you know, I'll be inspired by the seasons, or for example, for the yoga class, we might be inspired by like the yamas and niyamas and different yogic philosophy sometimes. And as far as, you know, the Tarot Society, I like to pull on my background reading tarot and palms and using kind of esoteric methods too. And I'm very inspired by the surrealists and the different surrealist writing exercises. And I try to read a lot about writing as well and see what other writers do to prompt their students, prompt themselves. And I try to pull a lot too from just universal themes. Like everyone can relate to love and pain. And so a lot of it is variations on that.
So what's the overlap then between teaching yoga and teaching writing? Because it seems like you're invested in both.
Yeah, absolutely. For me, it's really important that people feel like they have a safe space, because it's so difficult to create. There's that it's so difficult to create if you don't feel safe, if you don't feel settled in the moment. And there's that myth of the destructive writer. And I think that, you know, destructive writers create in spite of their self-destruction, at least in my experience. and so a lot of what I do is geared toward, you know, making it easier to write and making it easier to be with the self, be in the body. And I think the reason I like combining ritual and writing and yoga and writing is because first you have to be in the body and be present. And then you can move on with the rest of your life and create, or even just, you know, take a few breaths and get through the day. So I'm very focused on that first step. And I feel like they relate there. You have to be an experience.
In a more formal university setting, are you able to incorporate some of these rituals and exercises or not really?
I am, actually, which is great. We tend to do free writing at the beginning, and I have a wonderful friend in Ireland who does mindfulness counseling and mindfulness workshops for depression and anxiety, Jen Ardis. You can find her online. And she has a great mindfulness meditation, and I played it for them one day, and afterwards they were like, can we do more mindfulness? Does she have more of this? Yeah. And I think they really benefit, because especially like a lot of my students are like 18 to 20. You know, I have other age groups, but it's that fresh age where you're just becoming an adult and everything is terrifying. And so I think they find it very helpful. I don't think so. That's why we keep doing it.
Right. So what exactly do you teach at the university?
It's a whole bunch of things. You know, that's the beauty of adjuncting, is that everything comes up. So I've taught creative writing. I tend to teach a lot of intro to writing classes, like writing essentials. And I also teach something called Junior Writing Topics, which is essentially a global literature class. And that's been really lovely to teach, especially. I'm very invested in reading diverse writers from various ethnic backgrounds and gender identities, because we just get so much of dead white men, and a lot of my students are not dead white men. So
it's at least not dead, right? Yeah.
Not that there's anything wrong with that. It's so important to be able to identify with the things you read. And a lot of my students hadn't had that opportunity before college.
What do you feel is your responsibility as like a writing professor to kids who are 18 and they don't really know what writing is for yet, or they don't really know what it can do?
That's such a good question. I am very dedicated to the idea of writing as empowerment. I feel like I've written myself out of difficult and scary early life. And I want them to be able to express themselves. I want them to be able to use writing for catharsis, for empowerment. I want them to be able to write cover letters and get a really good job. I want them to be able to communicate their ideas. Critical thinking is really key as well. So much of what I do is, you know, teaching them to question authority and to think about the messages that they hear through media, through family, society at large, and really decide how they feel about it once they've examined all the evidence and thought about the implications really carefully. And so in some ways, it's almost like a philosophy class. And in other ways, it's, you know, tapping into this hard to define creative flow and just seeing what comes up there. And a lot of them are really afraid to do that too, because they feel like they aren't good writers, especially in the intro to writing class, because you know, there's an option to test out of it. And so if they haven't tested out of it, often they come in there with this idea that, like, I'm here because I'm bad at this.
No.
And I know, it's so sad. And that's not true for any of them. And it's just a matter of learning that method for empowerment. And so, you know, we talk about, especially in the global literature class, but all the time, honestly, too, in the intro to writing class, we talk about feminism and intersectional feminism, particularly because it relates to everything that we do and read, especially for mostly, I teach at a fashion college, mostly young women, and a lot of men who don't identify as, you know, hetero or maybe identify as non-binary, it's really important for them to feel like there's a place for them and their voices in the world and in the workforce.
So how do you build up that confidence?
A lot of it is a combination of what we read. And so, you know, they get an opportunity to hear voices like theirs. And other parts of it are we do a lot of kind of self-discovery writing prompts, which is so great with that age group particularly. But I think for everybody, it's really important to check in, you know, how do I actually feel about this? What are my desires? If I were a character or a speaker in a poem, what are my motivations? What's my yearning? And so the more that we do exercises like that, the more that they start to become impassioned and figure out that what they have to say is valid and worth expressing.
Yeah. Who are some of the people who come to the yoga studios and the Tarot Society workshops?
All kinds of people. We have a lot of, you know, writers who, like, their mainstay is writing, or they're here in New York because of writers' residencies or professors. We have professors of all kinds of things. But we also have, we've had doctors who are interested in,
ooh.
Yeah. One woman was telling me about, she's doing a degree for fun in narrative or as medicine.
Oh, at Columbia.
Yeah.
Yeah, they have a narrative medicine program.
Yeah. Yeah, and so, you know, she's a doctor, and she's like, well, I'm just doing this because it's fascinating, and, you know.
I'm just a genius.
Yeah. That's beautiful. And then we've had, like, crime reporters come in, people who tend to have some kind of expression, although we've definitely had engineers come in and be like, I have ideas, I want to write poems, and... And so people really from all over, and we've had students come in too, like college students, which has been great to see them, you know, looking for extracurricular writing opportunities, and yoga teachers, all kinds of people really, but everyone with something to say. And a lot of people come in too who want to become better journalers, which is really cool. It's like they're just writing for themselves or maybe writing for their families or thinking about a blog. So it's nice to... Because narrative has everything to do with that, too. And, it's nice to be able to work with all different genres, because it's open to all genres and all levels, which is great, because we're not, you know, creating a self-selecting sample or anything.
Hmm. How do you pick the texts for these classes?
A lot of it is what I've been moved by recently. I try to keep it fairly contemporary, but I definitely, you know, harken back to old favorites, but and I also, of course, have a sweet spot for Romani literature, and, you know, so few people know who, like, are more familiar with the racial slur Gypsy than the actual, like, our actual name, Romani, and don't know where we come from and don't know what our deal is. And I think literature and art is the best way to connect with a culture and understand its people. And it's often, you know, work that they've never heard before, and using like culturally significant metaphors that maybe they haven't encountered. And so I try to keep it fresh as possible. I look for writers who are doing something that that feels new or a twist on something, and try to bring it into class, because I don't want my students, and I don't want myself either, to fall into patterns and keep. I want them to feel safe, but I don't want them to feel afraid to take a leap with their work.
How do you even begin to teach aspects of a culture that you come from that most people have no basis in? Like, not even just like, oh, maybe we know a little bit of this or a little bit of that. Like, their entire basis of knowledge of your culture is slurs or stereotypes. How do you teach that?
I usually start with the stereotypes, because, I mean, I've literally had wonderful people come up to me and be like, I thought gypsies were magical creatures.
Oh, no.
And it's like, who can blame you, though? Like, that's all you see. Even Esmeralda in Disney, like, she's magic. She's not, like, a real person.
Yeah.
And so, you know, these huge cultural touchstones that, if they include Roma at all, it's almost never as real people. You know, thinking about, like, Stephen King's Thinner, like, were these terrifying creatures. And I just happen to have grown up in a family where dancing and fortune-telling are the family traits, which is actually fairly rare among Roma. And I still practice these trades partially because money, you don't make a lot of money as an adjunct professor, so I really do need side hustles. And partially because, you know, it's a connection to my family, my grandmother, who I'm so close to and who taught me these trades. And so I start there by talking about just who I am and all of the ways that I may appear to fit the stereotypes and then how I don't. And then I start talking about, I think history is really important, talking about the Roma. You have to talk about persecution, which is terrible, but, you know, we're a diasporic people. And so once I start explaining, you know, Roma came from India in the 10th century, the early Roma were likely low-caste Indians and African migrants who were rounded up to fight the invading Muslim troops. And it was a 100-year war that was mostly fought through the mountains of northern India. And when they lost, they had been there for about a century. They were allowed to bring their families with them in camps far off. And so there were generations of this enormous army, in which is essentially now a culture of people. And a lot of the soldiers didn't want to go back because they felt shamed. And some did. And those the people who did are now groups like the Bopa in Rajasthan, who are referred to as the Rajasthani Gypsies. And they have a distant link to us, but, you know, culturally are different. And then, you know, so Roma kept moving west, and during a time when, you know, witch hunts and a lot of hysteria and xenophobia were battling around in the minds of Europeans, especially. And so people showing up with, you know, Kali as the main goddess, who's now, you know, Sarala Kali or Isara Kali, our different version of her. And, you know, dark skin and speaking a language that's not familiar really freaked people out. And the church for a long time, and still does in some places, actively encouraged the persecution of Roma. And this persecution hasn't really stopped. And we don't have a home country. It's difficult to get representation in places like the UN. And just last night at a bar, someone asked me, like, what are the Roma fighting for? Are you fighting for a country? And it's like, not at all. We're just fighting for equal rights and fighting for a stop to the hate crimes and like stop forcible sterilization of Romani women, which is still happening in Europe and happened in this country as well up until the 80s. And, you know, just stop killing us.
So crazy that you have to make that argument in Boys of Bars. Yeah. But also not a huge surprise to me that would be something you had to do.
Yeah, boys, not men.
Right? No, he was nice about it. He just didn't know the deal. But, yeah, so, I mean, I start with myself a little bit and then start with history because it's so important for them to connect it to a person. And I've definitely had students, even fairly recently, I had a student complain that she didn't want a gypsy as a professor.
What?
Yeah.
How did that come about? How did you find out?
I found out because the dean called me in and talked to me about it. And essentially it was like, can you be less of a gypsy in class? It's making students uncomfortable.
Ooh.
And she didn't realize, I think, exactly what she was asking me. And when she did realize, then the tune completely changed.
Yeah, backtracked, right?
Yeah.
Well, what did she mean initially? Which is, like, can you be a little bit less of your culture, of yourself? Like,
Yeah, you know, she was wondering, I mean, I think what made her nervous or what gave her pause was that we read a story by a Romani writer. And I explained, like, I have a global literature slant in my class. We read work from all kinds of people, mm-hmm. all kinds of ethnic backgrounds and, you know, gender identities and all of these things, which is something that the college really does want. We have a fairly diverse group of students, it's especially important. And I think there, even though it was clear, even from my syllabus, that we were reading from different cultures, I think there's still that idea that Roma aren't a people, that it's just a way of life, and that it's, you know, Roma are just a band of, like, lazy fortune tellers who throw curses and steal things, which is not true, of course. So I think that was the misunderstanding. And then, you know, after talking to her for a little while about who the Roma are, she, you know, I'm glad you're teaching what you're teaching. That's fine. But, you know, when I lived in Florida, this hasn't happened in New York, but when I lived in Florida and was teaching, I had students yell racist invective at me and tell me that, you know, Hitler didn't kill enough of us. And just there's still a lot of anger surrounding that. And so I think it's really important to, like, humanize Roma first rather than, which is why it's important for me to bring my persona into the classroom a little bit, which is why it's important for every teacher to bring, or professor to bring their persona in, because you're a human being teaching and you have to connect with your students on some personal level too.
Gosh. Have you found a Romani community in New York? There must be one, right?
Yeah, there is, especially there are, I mean, when I say a lot of Roma in academics, I'm like, I can think of four. But, so, I mean, the Romani academic community is quite small and tight, and there's the Gypsy Letters and Gypsy Arts and Letters Conference every year, and so the Romani.
What is that?
It's usually hosted by NYU, and there are like Siv Brun and a few others in the NYU music department tend to organize this conference, and it's an opportunity usually for Roma and music and academics to come together, but we have like dancers and writers and ethnomusicologists and anthropologists come, and it's really interesting, and there are some non-Roma who come and present, and there's definitely, I mean, you're having a lot of different disparate I'm going to say tribes, but Roma aren't really a tribal society, but a lot of different subgroups of Roma come together, and there are arguments about things, and especially...
bring all the family to town.
Yeah.
All their fight.
And so it's really interesting to see through agreement and disagreement, you know, how people understand our culture. And we've definitely had people outside of the Romani community come in and tell us how we are, which has been difficult, but mostly it's an awesome event, and everyone gets a chance to talk, which is great, and there's a Romani community panel as well, but it's so heartening to see how many Roma are doing amazing things in the arts and academics, and in like street art, and you know, on the community level. And there's this phrase, Opera Roma, which Roma rise up, and it just embodies that whole movement. It's kind of our battle cry for the human rights movement, Opera Roma. And so there's a community, definitely, and oddly, Facebook, you know, kind of like Black Twitter, there's like Romani Twitter and Romani Facebook, which is cool. And so there, I know, like, people online as well. This, I feel like I have a community there, which is cool, and I haven't met a lot of them, but yet work with them a lot and have a lot of discussions.
How do you incorporate Roma themes into your own writing? Or is it something that you actively do, or something that subconsciously happens?
For a long time, I didn't write about it because I'm not full Romani. I didn't grow up in a community. You know, it's on my mother's side through my grandmother. And I felt for a long time that I didn't have a right to it. But after some time, I had a professor tell me that I was writing badly. And no, it was true. And he was like, you're not, this is Robert Olin Butler, actually. And he was like, you're not writing anything that's really close to your heart. Hmm. And honestly, to prove him wrong, because I'm a spiteful little monster sometimes, I was like, well, I'm going to write about Romani stuff, and he won't even know that, you know, and he's going to tell me it's terrible, and I'm going to be like, well, this is close to my heart. This is my real truth. And he read it, and he was like, oh, this is way better. So, then I thought maybe I'm, like, repressing a little bit of my, I hate that term authentic, but, like, repressing a part of myself that's actually quite significant. And once I started telling my own stories, not to say that my work is all autobiographical, but Once I started allowing myself to write about it, suddenly everything opened up. And now my novel is about a Romani, or part Romani woman in post-World War II Paris who becomes a Nazi hunter and, you know, works at a circus as a dancer and fortune teller. And parts of that are inspired by my grandmother's life, living through World War II in Germany as a Romani woman, as a Sinti woman. And Sinti being a group related to the Roma that... It's like an offshoot of, you could call it another Romani tribe, but there are some differences that make some Sinti people refuse to be identified as Roma, which I should clarify. But, and it's not entirely clear to even me how much Sinti blood I have versus Romani blood. And at some level, I just don't feel like it's important at all. But it's just, you know, it's culture. It's what you're raised with. But, yeah, so writing about her experiences too, and she's cool with that. You know, she's been wanting to write her own story, and I got her a tape recorder so she can record her stories, but she's made it really clear, like, you are... It's a lot of my family is embarrassed about being Romani and deny it and don't want to live it, and a lot of my family is white passing and just kind of goes with that as much as they can, which I can't say I blame them. But, you know, she's like, you live this, you claim it, it's your job now to tell our stories, and, you know, you have a responsibility to talk about this. And so I took that really seriously, especially someone who lived through a genocide and has enormous gravity. And so I tell her stories, too.
Yeah. Well, on that note, we'd love to hear you read some of your work.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah, we know our listeners want to hear it.
So I have one story called Stepless. I write a lot of prose poetry, so we can call it that. Stepless. I grew up hearing that every woman in my Romani family was a dancer, or every woman worth talking about. I learned to dance in my grandmother's trailer in New Hampshire, where the trailer park flooded every spring, and my mother and I waded through waist-high water, wearing black trash bags, on the lookout for water snakes I hoped to punch and curse, spit my own venom, rescue us. But I never caught more than dancing ripples, bleeding indistinguishably into muddy depths. Romani dance has steps and requires skill. But its essence is the spirit of improvisation. The fierce, stomping La Chunga, our most famous dancer, inspiration to Picasso, was never formally trained. That stomping is the rage of the oppressed. My great-great-grandmother danced in trances up and down the riparian towns of the Danube. She taught my grandmother, who then danced in German nightclubs amidst post-World War II rubble. When she descended from the stage, men took her in their arms, but inevitably snapped when she didn't follow their lead. "I don't follow steps," she told them. "I dance how I feel, and now I feel I'd like to dance alone." My mother and aunt were born in America in the 50s in rural New Hampshire, where there was little demand for gypsy dancers. They traded horses and modeled in bikini contests that the cocktail bars they waitressed in held on cold water beaches. When men hurt them, they wrapped themselves in leather and metal, smoked cigars, tried to intimidate whoever might want them. Both danced stepless, both raped through childhood by the American schizophrenic soldier who plucked my grandmother from the wreckage, because being a gypsy in war-torn Germany was not all dancing. The hungry smoke devoured Roma and Sinti, and my family survived by fate, by German men taking them, promising to save their little dancers, beating and raping them and their children bloody, because surely that's better than the camps, little dancer, surely better than death. When you're this kind of gypsy girl, and you begin performing the stepless dance at 14, you don't remember when men grope you. You may be 4 or 5 when you first come home bleeding between your legs. Your mother's eyes glaze over as she mops up the evidence of force, rolling back to where no one helped her either, because surely it was better to pretend. Where was she as she applied the cool white cloth? Where was she in her red bikini on the beach? You bled over and over and learned never to step on the earth with your full weight. You didn't find your way to school often, but you're smart and go to college. When men ask you to play the gypsy dancer at their bachelor parties, you know you're exploited, peddling stereotypes. Know they touch you because of who you are, and you can't afford to say no. And who can remember how it went? You quit when you can to model nude in art classes. Years later, when you leave your husband and his rage problem, and he's spent your money, and your family is ravaged by addiction and mental illness, you have nowhere to go and $27, and you're still modeling. You need to pay rent, but can't find more employment fast enough. You may take your first step inside a gentleman's club, looking for honest work, spinning in a grimy neon foyer. An Indian man gives you your first night advice, and that's don't be cold, don't tease. Don't remember his largesse forces you still as he sucks your breast in the VIP lounge. You look Indian, so pretty. You don't feel anything all night, only weight in his glinting wedding band. Other Indian boys give you dollars on the pole without routine. You see them love it, then recoil, like you could be their sister, and they leave you feeling this. White guys want you for private dances, so exotic. What are you? What are you? What are you? Don't remember they hold you down. The Sicilian tourist who wants you most strikes with a fat, flat palm, grips your breath in his hands, uses his teeth. Don't remember how far security is. Don't remember scrambling against the wall, the blows that fall from confusing directions. Don't remember wading through his weight inside. You drive home at 4 a.m. crying, but have no idea why, while Call Me Al blares from your radio. You notice the next morning that bruises and blood muddy your whole body, and that's when you start to remember. There was none of your venom, just an extra 20 for your trouble. At home, shades drawn, your body is its own shadow. You bathe, and from beneath the ripples say aloud again and again, I'd like to dance alone.
Thank you so much for sharing that with us.
Thank you.
So I actually have a question that just occurred to me while you were reading that to me, that there must be a complicated relationship between Roma and Indian men in particular, it seems like what you're saying. Is that something that is a part of your culture, or is that something that you in particular experienced?
That's a good question. I think in that particular piece it's more incidental that I'm mistaken a lot for Indian. Mm-hmm. And depending on what kind of mood I am and what kind of mood I'm in, sometimes I explain it and sometimes I don't. but mostly, you know, what's interesting is that India has recently claimed Roma as a their diaspora
really?
Group. And so that was optimistic for a lot of people. And I think what's been difficult is that a lot of outsiders especially want to pin us as something. And so they'll say we're Indian, but we're really not. There's a significant Indian thumbprint on our DNA, but and there's still cultural carry-ons, like, you know, our patron goddess or patron saint, if you're a Catholic, Saint Sarah was originally Kali. And Kali has made a lot of changes. I think Roma are kind of squeamish, so she dropped all the severed heads and arms. And, you know, she's a lot, like, prettier, but she has that crazy edge of chaos to her still, and this idea that she's a protectress of a people who have suffered intensely, and so she carries on that terrible mother aspect of Kali. But, so it has... I find a lot of my Indian friends, too, it's been a lovely connection between us, where it's like we have this old history almost, and it's fun to compare, you know, what things are still there and what things aren't, or which things aren't. But, you know, I find it more of a problem maybe with, maybe I should say, I find it easier to explain what I am to Indian people than I do to, I guess, other people. Because I, even now, you know, I teach yoga in a place in Ditmas Park, and I've been maybe unnecessarily nervous about explaining myself because Eastern Europe has a really heated relationship with Roma, and there's still a lot of frightening government propaganda about Roma. I mean, I saw a Polish commercial that was calling for, like, literally stomping out Roma. There was an image of, like, a mosquito that was supposed to represent the Romani people, and the government was slapping it. And
oh my God.
Like, yeah. And that was for Jewish people as well. And so there's a heavy, like, neo-Nazi presence. And I should assume that people who are coming to yoga class really don't carry that with them, but like, I've been nervous to like tell them, yeah, I'm also here reading palms and, you know, tarot and my Romani family's tradition. And nobody has been weird to me about it. It's always been like, oh, yeah, there are lots of Roma where I'm from. That's cool. But I've had other experiences outside of, you know, my happy bubble community. Where it's been a real problem for me. You know, people have assumed that I was a sex worker, and which is, like, in itself not a problem, but the way they treated me, it was like, okay, so you're available, and I can do whatever I want to you. Oh. I've had people say awful things to my face, or one of my favorite, like, least favorite things is I'll tell people that, you know, I'm Romani if they ask about my ethnicity, and then within seconds they'll be like, well, I went to Italy and my tour guide was telling us that gypsies steal and all of these, and I was just like, okay, cool. I mean, I met a white person once who was super racist. What am I gonna do? But it's a hard thing to explain, but I feel like mostly there's kinship with the Indian community.
You know, now that I'm thinking about it, I remember when, so Christine and I went to one of your workshops recently that was very heavily focused on the ritual of writing. And to me in particular, that was really valuable because, you know, I write all my poems like on Google Docs, like on the train, like I don't make any space or any time to write. And I really love the idea of it. And I remember you brought out a Kali candle.
I did, yeah.
And so, yeah, so what is that, why is that ritual of the candle and of sort of bringing in Kali, how does that relate to your writing?
At least in the tradition I grew up with, my grandmother taught me meditation, and she wouldn't have ever called it meditation because I don't think she knew what that was until I became a yoga teacher. And, but she was always meditating, and a lot of the practice, like Roma light candles as an act of devotion and prayer all the time. And it's one of our more central traditions that I've found a lot of different Roma from all over the world also do this. And so lighting candles is always a big deal. I mean, the way my grandmother told me once when I was really little, she was like, oh, it's so, you know, the gods and ancestors can see us, like, which I thought was so beautiful. I don't know if that's a widely held belief, but yeah, so for me, right, lighting a candle and burning incense and using salt water, it invokes all of the elements, and it's something that carries our intention up beyond us. And so if we're invoking creativity, you know, no matter what kind of, if you're atheist or spiritual or whatever, if you're invoking some kind of creative, I guess, spirit, for lack of a better word, creative energy, I like to draw on that idea that we're being seen and something that we're calling for and asking for. And even if that's something that you're looking for within yourself, it's sending a message. And I use the Kali candle specifically because I like the idea of the element of fate and chaos, and I feel like writing prompts really call on that because they're structured, right? Like, I tell you guys something I'm going to write about, but then you don't necessarily have to do it. And a lot of it is chance, what I bring into class. And, you know, it strikes students in all different ways. They might, you know, be like, okay, that was nice, I'm going to do my own thing, or which is great. Or it might be like, oh my goodness, I was thinking about that exactly. And there might be like a real deep resonance with it. And Roma believe in both free will and fate. And this idea that, you know, every decision we make has endless ripples and we can continue to make our own decisions. But Kali or Sarala Kali kind of slips her hand in when she can, and sometimes that pattern or her own influence might swirl around for a while in the midst of everyone else's chaos, but eventually finds its place, maybe in a different way. And so I think writing is a lot like that. You can choose to show up at the page and you can choose where to go, but there are certain elements that are just going to strike you that feel almost predestined.
For our Brooklyn listeners who haven't been to the Tarot Society in Bushwick, how would you describe that space?
It is an adorable, quirky little place on Charles Plaza, or Charles Place, right off of Myrtle. And there's always delightful graffiti outside. And it's kind of an intimate space. There's a reading room, and then there's also a main room where they have a lot of different merchandise, like they sell tarot cards and candles and Reiki charged beauty products, and now there's a bunch of like totes and t-shirts, and all with the, like, eclectic vibes and esoteric origins. But and then there are also spell boxes recently now.
Oh, like, what's that?
Like, I just found out. Wait, yeah.
Right. I think they might have some from London Conjure. I know Caitlin Foisey is one of my favorite Romani artists and performers. And she doesn't work with Tarot Society, but has a close relationship with them. And she works for London Conjure, which is a cool thing that you should look up. And there's a road opening box with like a chicken foot and all kinds of things. That it's like basically a ritual in a box with instructions, and you have all the materials, everything you need, and it's all been, you know, cleansed and ready for you. So if you feel like gathering, if you'd like to do a ritual, but you feel like you're a witch on the go and you need something
busy witch,
yeah, need something ready made for your cosmopolitan life, spell boxes are really helpful because you just pick it up and then you get to work. You don't have to go around looking for chicken feet and, you know, all kinds of things. It's already there for you.
It's true. It's like I have my 9 to 5. I don't have time to stop by the butcher and get my chicken feet.
I don't.
It's true.
So there's cool stuff there, and they try to have at least 2 readers there, so, you know, it's really walk-in friendly. You can just walk in and you can get a reading for, you know, a half an hour, hour and a half, and all kinds of readers there. There are lots of events, too. Like, constantly we have events from, like, sacred smoking blends workshop, where you, like, mix your own teas and smoking blends, to, ooh, like, concerts and performances. There was a workshop that I really wanted to go to, but had to work, I think it was like witches and sluts about like feminism and sexual empowerment and
the dream
in the pagan community, right? And it's like, I belong there. it was just, I really like the vibe there. It's such a, it's a great community space. And so it's nice to start the writer's circle and see who comes in and, you know, what they bring to it. It's open to a lot of different kinds of traditions, which is lovely.
Yeah. How did you find the space?
Actually, Caitlin Foisey had recommended it to me because I was, you know, I had just moved to New York a little over a year ago and was asking her, you know, where I should go, because, you know, trying to figure out what kind of client base would suit me best. And so she recommended that among other places, and I really jived there, and Darcy Leonard and Kevin Pellerine run it, and they're both really beautiful people, and so it's a happy place.
I'm curious, does reading people's cards, does that impact you at all in terms of how you end up, like, teaching writing? Like, it seems like both have a very, I don't know, I want to say, like, emotionally open quality to it?
They do. That's a great way of describing it. Yes, it does. I get the question a lot, like, do you want to lift from your clients' lives? And the answer is no. I think because our human stories are so similar. You know, like, people come in with heartbreaks and career concerns. And also when I'm reading, maybe it's because I'm, you know, meditating. My grandmother was always really adamant about, like, you have to get in a place where your mind is completely clear. You can see the pictures moving beneath the lines on the palm, or mm-hmm. beneath the cards, beneath the tea leaves. And so I'm in a kind of zone when I'm reading for someone. And so afterwards, I don't often remember minute details of their lives. But first, I would never do that because ethically, that's terrible. But and second, it's just, I think reading has shown me how important our own stories are to us and the idea that we have of ourselves, and how sometimes telling old stories about, you know, what we are like and how trauma has made us. I think a lot of people identify so strongly with the pain that they've been through and think of themselves as made by trauma, that a lot of my work with clients centers around thinking or finding symbols that can build the self again and bring people into the present and help them make choices about their lives. And of course, you know, the cards will suggest, like, well, it looks like maybe you'll have a new career opportunity, or there might be a new person in your life, or your boyfriend is the worst and you need to leave.
But you just need the cards to say it because you are not listening to anyone else.
And they always know, too. They're like, I know, he's the worst.
Let me make my mistakes.
And so there's that, definitely, but I think with reading, giving readings and encouraging people to write, a lot of the same connection to one's own story comes up. You don't have to write autobiographical things. I certainly don't all the time, but you have to be familiar with your own story. And so I find a lot of the same techniques apply, like deep self-searching things. And I often recommend, you know, kind of rituals to my clients depending on what they're going through. And so it seemed really natural then to recommend rituals to writers and to create a space where we're doing that and moving through the ego, moving through trauma, moving through fear, because everyone seems to be doing that anyway, the people who come to me by any rate.
I'm terrified of having my cards read, of having anything read. So what would you tell people like me?
I think you have to be careful about the readers that you go to, because I've met them. There are readers who want to be dramatic and scare the shit out of you, which I think is ethically irresponsible. And so
that's a nice word for it.
Being diplomatic.
Well, that's a curse on this show.
So, I mean, my grandmother always taught me, and I think a lot of readers, though, really do try to be responsible, and my grandmother always taught me there's certain ethics, like, you don't tell someone that they're going to die, because you don't really know that. Yeah, and also,
I always wondered about that, like, even if you see something that might imply that, it's just not a good idea to go there?
It's not a good idea, because it makes people crazy. Yeah. And so, there are other ways to talk about it, like, other ways to be like, like, self-care is important. And now I'm afraid that everyone who I talk to is like, you need to take better care of yourself. They're going to be like, oh my gosh, she's trying to tell me that I'm going to die. But, like, I pretty much, like, never really see that. But there was one instance where my grandmother was reading for a friend, and she saw that her daughter was going to die. And my grandmother is, like, spooky in that way, too. And the girl did die in a car crash. And my grandmother didn't tell her friend about it because she didn't know how it was going to play out. She just saw that she was going to lose someone really close to her. And so she, you know, gave her that kind of, like, you know, tell your loved ones to be careful. But what are you going to do with a 16-year-old girl who gets in a car crash? You know, that's not something that she could have controlled or her mother could have controlled. And so after that, my grandmother didn't want to read for anybody for a really long time.
Wow.
Because it really scarred her. And I've been lucky so far that I haven't had terrifying, dramatic things happen like that as a reader. I've definitely had, I've read clients who were dying, but our purpose was a lot different. You know, it's like, what are we going to do? How are you going to navigate this? And so I feel like I got a little off topic, but what I would say is that, at least in the Romani tradition that I grew up in, like, you don't tell someone that they're going to die. You don't focus on the negative things. Instead, if you see that, it's like, oh, wow, you sabotaged the crap out of yourself, you would be like, well, here are some things that maybe you should do instead. You know, maybe focus on, like, your fears and try to figure out what you're afraid of. And, you know, these cards indicate that you have a lot of skills and talents in this direction. You should keep doing that. And so the purpose is to help the person who comes in feel better about where they're going and have a clearer idea of what they want and what they should do. And you don't tell them what to do, but you give them an opportunity to work it out with you using the symbols that just happen to come up. And so at least my method is far more conversational than, you know, doomsday, like laying out the cards like in The Simpsons with all the death cards.
So Christine, when are you going to set up your cards
read? Still terrified.
See, I love the idea of getting cards read. I just think that it's such, I mean, for me personally, it feels like a form of therapy every time I've gotten any sort of card work done.
I kind of joke that it's unlicensed therapy.
Yeah, right? No, for real, because I think so many times, like, it's not that I've done it a whole lot, but you hear the things that you knew you needed to hear, and, like, maybe you had a friend or a loved one tell you, like, hey, so maybe this is what's going on, and you should really stop, and blah, 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 and it just helps when you feel like the universe or there's some other force reinforcing that, and it's just a different way to hear what you need to hear.
Yeah, I totally agree, and it's kind of beautiful to point out what's there and have the client resonate or, you know, tell you maybe it's something else and work through it with somebody. It feels like a collaborative effort, at least the method I grew up with.
Does anyone come to you in particular for, like, work with their writing or their art? Would they say, like, all right, like, I want to facilitate either a story or and artistic collaboration? How do you utilize the cards in that way?
Yes, that happens a lot, actually. I get a lot of relationship questions and career questions, and career questions especially from artists. And I wonder if it's because I'm established in that world too. But I love working with artists and, you know, talking about where their art can go and things they can do. Like, I model sometimes for a tattoo studio in Brooklyn, Armageddon Ink Gallery. My favorite tattoo artist, Britt, is there. You should go to her.
Hey, Britt.
And so sometimes I model for them, and I ended up reading palms, like, afterwards. And it was so great to work with tattoo artists because their art is so interesting, and they have so many different talents in the visual arts. And so I read with a lot of different kinds of artists, too, which is great. And the more I meet new communities, the more I learn about these paths.
All right, back up. Wait. So when you say you model at a tattoo gallery, what does that mean?
That's a good question. Yeah. So I'm also an art model, and so I modeled for their drink and draw sometimes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It's helpful.
We need a person to stand there while we tattoo this other person.
That would be cool. I'm hoping for that.
Ooh,
that's where my head went. I was like, I know she does art modeling, but
like when we see like someone on, like we see someone with like Jess on their body, you'd be like, oh, that's
I know
that.
Her.
I know.
That's my goal.
I see that it looks like you just got a new tattoo. Am I wrong?
I did. Britt gave me a tattoo last night.
Oh my gosh. Can you talk a little bit about it? I love new tattoos.
Yeah. So she, she's really great at,
stunning.
It's watercolor.
Yeah. Tell our listeners exactly what it is.
Okay, so I have stories, but I'll make them real quick. So the first one that she did for me was covering up a scar from a time when my first boyfriend, when I was like 14, tried to kill me. And so it was really important for it to be awesome, and it's this like powerful, terrifying deer half-skull creature. And on the other side, my ex-husband designed this tattoo, and he's a really talented artist. And he's my ex, so I wanted something to, I love the tattoo, I would never get rid of it, but I wanted to make it fresh, and so she added color to it, because it was this adorable little chickadee with its wings spread, happy to see me, because he knew that's exactly what I wanted, and so she watercolored all over it, so now it looks like it's splashing in, like, puddles of many colors of paint, and it feels like I'm honoring that his artwork is on my body, but I'm making it new for myself. And so, yeah, that was a really lovely thing. And I feel like I need to add I didn't have him draw because he was my husband. It's just that no other artist could get it right, and he knew me that well that he was like, I know this is the chickadee you want.
The chickadee of your dreams.
So, yeah, she She did an amazing job. She's really great, especially if you, I mean, she's great for any tattoo, but it was important to me, like, going with her with these very personal tattoos. And she was just like, when I told her the story about the ex, she was like, the bastard, continue. What do you want? It's like, thank you. Thank you for being great.
People can be great artists and perhaps not the best people at the same time.
And she's just phenomenal. So I can't say enough about her.
Could you talk a little bit more about your art modeling, what you do around town?
Yeah, so I model for Brooklyn Art Space, and I model for a lot of smaller studios, and it's a tremendous amount of fun. And so I love working individually with artists as well. Like, I've had a few artists come up to me and say, some for photography, some for life drawing, say that they had a certain project in mind. And because I'm a yoga teacher, I can do a lot of weird things for a while. And so I usually work with artists who want, like, unusual poses.
Put your foot on your head.
Yeah, what's the weirdest thing someone's ever asked you to do?
I've had a lot of, like, can you be upside down for a while? And I'm like, absolutely.
Oh, good for you.
Wow.
Like, I wouldn't do, like, a handstand for...
But you can do an inversion. You
know. Yeah, but, like, hanging off a chair upside down with my legs, like, in crazy directions. It's like, yeah, I can totally do that. And I'm flexible in certain directions, and so I do a lot of, like, crawling, like, cat-like on the floor with, like, my leg up by my head kind of stuff. That actually Britt did a painting of me like that. It was a Fuck Trump painting, and I'm kind of, like, in the background, like, crawling like a strange jaguar. So, yeah, that kind of stuff. And it's so cool to work with artists on that level, too. And, you know, I teach art on Fridays at a middle school, at the Windmill Montessori School. And so it's nice to work with artists of all ages.
What first drew you to art modeling? Was it the money? Was it the...
Oh, it was totally the money.
Not gonna lie.
Yeah. Was it very freeing, and this is why you wanted to do it? Like, I love when people are like, no, I'm an artist, and so I also need money to eat food.
Yeah. I started off, though, at Hollins University, an all-women's college, and so it was very, like, freeing, and it was just, it was a lovely experience, and I was 18, and I was like, I need money, I am very poor, and so it was a nice environment, and then it's just been kind of like fortune-telling. It's like, I can do it anywhere, I don't need any props or tools, really, except for a deck of cards and a, you know, bathrobe, depending, and, you know, it's just one of those things that's always supported me, and it's interesting, I get to meditate basically for 3 hours, I don't have to talk to anybody.
Really? So that's what you do, like, in your brain space?
Yeah, I write my novel in my head and my poems and things like that, just, and, you know, take notes in between, and... it's actually a really creative space for me, which is great. And artists are usually very respectful and, you know, aren't at all creepy.
I was hoping you could briefly explain what you love about teaching children art.
Oh, yes. So, they are just, I mean, this is so obvious, but, like, they're so creative. They come up with better ideas than I do all the time. Like, I had them drawing caravans for, like, Romany Rights Day, and they were like, can we build them out of popsicle sticks? And I was like, yes, that's an amazing idea. And I love seeing students who feel like they can't draw all of a sudden come up with amazing things. And a lot of these students in particular, this is, like, the sweetest middle school I've ever encountered. Everyone's friends, no one's being ostracized. And I'm just, you know, one boy was making a collage, like, this is my feminist role model collage of, like, powerful women.
And there was
and there was another boy who was like, I'm making a founding mothers collage because founding fathers is sexist and it excludes women who were important. These kids are like 11.
Oh my gosh.
And then there's a little girl who's like, I'm drawing myself as a superhero. I'm an Amazonian and I'm conquering the city. And I was like, yes, you are.
Well, on that note, thank you so much, Jess. You've been listening to the Badass Lady Folk of Brooklyn on Radio Free Brooklyn. I'm Christine Stoddard.
And I'm Mari Pack.
Tune in next week.